Hello and welcome to Big Sisters in STEM. My name is Jasmine and this week we're joined by two amazing guests. We've got Charlene, who is a fashion business technology academic here at the University of Manchester. And we've got Aman, who is finishing university this year. She's 4 years into her journey because she also did a year of industry experience. So to get started today, I wanted to chat about how important it is to be the main character in your own life and not let somebody else decide your path for you. Mm. So I guess that kind of means me asking how you got into the areas that you've both gotten into. How did you find your path and then begin to tread it?
Okay, I'll go first. Yeah. So my path into academia was purely by accident, purely by chance. So I never set out to be an academic. I didn't really have an understanding of what that was. So I wanted to get in and get out of university as fast as I could and get into the world of work and start working in industry. That was my passion. So, you know, when I was ready to graduate, my whole focus wasn't on continuing study. It was about obviously venturing into the field of work, which I did do. I applied for many, many jobs. I think I've told you this before. I probably applied for upwards of 50, 60 positions just straight after
it's
graduation.
It's the rite of passage.
It is the rite of passage. And I was lucky enough to get my first role in the States, in New York, for a well-known global brand. I'm not supposed to say the names. But yeah, it was Ralph Lauren.
We tried 3 minutes in.
And whilst I was there, it was fantastic. It was a fantastic experience. I was, you know, living my dream as a graduate, everything I wanted to do in fashion. I was designing. I then moved, kind of took a sidestep into marketing. I realised very quickly that there's not a lot of money in designing if your name is not in lights. So then I found a more viable option for me in terms of my career and what I wanted out of life in marketing. So I ventured into that territory and, you know, it just took off from there. From that company, I then moved to another company in Spain and worked for Inditex, which the brands they own is Zara, Pull&Bear, Bershka, for example. So it was a very different field of work. So it went from being luxury sportswear to now into fast fashion, of what you'd call it, fast fashion. So it was a baptism of fire, very steep learning curve, but I learned so much about consumer psychology and, you know, innovation and, you know, because it's such a fast moving cycle working for a company like Inditex. At that same time, I was working, it was about 2008, so that kind of, you know, tells my age. The recession hit and, you know, we just decided, me and my partner, to come back to the UK and just reset. Basically, it's very difficult to kind of continue in a different country.
Is that where you got into academia then, back in 2008?
2009 it was.
Wow.
Yeah, so
I didn't realize it's been that long.
It's been that long.
Because I think of you as having all of that industry experience. I'm always just like, she must have just got here. Like, you've done so much.
I've been an academic for a long time. And yeah, so we came back to the UK. One of my good pals was teaching at a university in Liverpool, John Moores. And she just said, come and do a guest lecture. You know, they'll love you. You've got industry experience. It adds value. So I did. And I kind of never looked back. And it was something that just clicked. It was like,
what was it that, when you did a lecture, was there something about that situation that made you realise I really like...
Yeah, as corny as it sounds, I did feel like I was adding value and giving back. And I saw the students, and I saw students who looked like me, you know, had probably my same background. And I really just wanted to help them along in their journey, because I know how tough it can be to get into an industry like fashion. And I know that it's not just about sheer talent. It's about having that grit, but also having the resilience and, you know, knowing people who can open doors for you, and the networking that comes back from it. So I just loved it. I loved, you know, I loved teaching. Yeah, people always laugh at me in our department, because many people are there for the research side.
Yeah, and that is not uncommon to hear from an academic.
And they're there for the research side, and the teaching is maybe just secondary. Whereas for me, put me in the classroom with the students all day, every day, and that's my happy place. And like you said, 2009, it's now 2024, and I'm still here kicking about. But I think when I came to this institution, it was probably the first time that I actually realised that the fashion industry is very much a STEM subject. Before, I always saw it as the arts, I always saw it as the creative arts, but there's so much kind of technology and engineering and computer science. Mm-hmm. There's so much of those kind of foundational STEM subjects that really supports the whole beast of fashion.
Especially and not as it's changing now and evolving.
Exactly. And not many people really realise that. And I think I've probably waffled on and deviated from the original.
No,
but yeah, that's exactly how I got into academia, basically. So
not at all. Yeah. I think I'd like to go back to how you got into fashion as well. Mm-hmm. But because we're talking about that computer science element, it would kind of be interesting to know from you, Aman, how you got into computer science, because you told me that you kind of thought maybe medicine was the first thing you were considering. Yeah. How did it go into this kind of much more tech and coding side for you?
So at the beginning
with a big
let me go all the way back.
Yeah.
Well, so my parents wanted me to do medicine. That was the first thing. So like it's very common I grew up in Pakistan. I moved to the UK when I was 18, and it was very common at that time for, like, if you've got a girl, like, just, you know, we want her to be a doctor. My parents only had me, and then there were three brothers. I have three younger brothers, so it was just their only girl. They were like, oh my god, we want you to be a doctor. And I was like, okay. I can try, but I wasn't really trying from the beginning. My heart wasn't into it at all. So at my school, you had to get grades. So people with the best grades, like, they could go into medicine. And the second best was computer science. So obviously, I wasn't really trying much to get into medicine. So I got
you enough grade, but you weren't really going for it. Okay.
So like I got the grades that could get me into computer science, but obviously not into medicine. No, at this moment, I didn't really know anything about computer science. You know, this was completely new to me. I had no idea.
So how old are you when you're saying you didn't know what it was? Like 13?
Yeah, probably.
12, 13?
No, I think it's 13. Yeah. 12 or 13, probably, yeah. And, we got shy with Visual Basic. It's like a coding language, and it's very simple. And obviously, we were very young at that moment. And I was so interested from the beginning. I was like, whoa, so like if you do this, this can do this. You know, it's like the whole point of being a computer scientist basically is like just slave over your code, and then after that, like, you just have to go and like just see that it works, and that is your that is basically all you're doing everything over, like, just that little bit of like whatever you see on the screen. And I started going forwards into this. So like I had a module. It was just a module, like mathematics. I was really good at maths as well. I thought about that for a while.
Because they're so similar, maths. Yeah, exactly. And maths science, and computer science. It's a big overlap.
Yeah, and like my dad's always been to maths. Like, he's always been, oh my god, maths is my favorite subject. And like, he would sit me down, and like, you know, there's memes about like your dad teaching you maths and then you're crying.
That was me.
That was me as well.
That was me, honestly. And I know we all relate, because he would always be like, okay, come here. Like, oh, I don't know why. Like, I was just like, oh, you know, I want to make him happy. So I just go and ask him, oh, can you explain this problem to me? And then he would try and explain it to me. And I'd just be like, never mind. Why did I ever ask? Why did I ask? But yeah.
But you did enjoy it, though.
I did enjoy it, okay. Actually, you know, I really like listening to music while I do things. And maths is the only thing, and coding as well, where like you can put your headphones in and you can start working on things and you can just do both of them together. Whereas the rest of it is just your thoughts and the book, and you know, it's because sometimes it's just I like having some background noise in my head.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
to, like,
same.
Do things. Yeah.
I love those ambience videos. That's what I listen to when they have really weirdly specific titles and they're like point of view. It's raining outside. You've got a cappuccino on your desk. There's a cat on your lap.
On YouTube. Yeah.
Your jumper is really fluffy right now.
And they've got like a little backdrop on the screens as well on YouTube. And it's like, like rain pouring down and you can hear those noises. I know exactly what you mean.
Setting. Yeah. So you were saying that you like coding. When did that come along that you thought, or got to try coding? And then what was it about it that made you think, okay, yes, computer science?
I actually got to do proper coding in college. So like, we did C, and it's a programming language. Mm. And I was just like, it was, again, like very basic things, you know, it wasn't anything complicated, but
to you now, maybe basic. If I was to look at it,
yeah, you'd probably be like, ooh, but it was just like adding numbers, multiplying numbers, getting, like, taking input from a user and then giving output out. So like 2 + 2, what is that? And it was still so interesting. And, you know, like just figuring out how to, I don't know. I always feel like with coding, it's so, like, when you work on it, it's so worth it at the end when, like, you see your output and it, like, there's always like a reward, like instant reward. Like, I mean, it's never instant. Like, you work on it for hours and hours and you actually see your code working. It's actually really, like, it's rewarding, and that's why I do it. That's why I still do it.
Always describe it as being really fun.
You can make it fun. Like,
yeah.
Let's say, like, fashion. You know, when computer science was first invented, let's say, whatever it was, you would never think that it would be in fashion.
No.
You know, like, never. Like, you couldn't even think of a way you could integrate it into fashion, you know? Because it's everywhere. Like, right now, when we're applying for companies, you don't go for, like, tech companies anymore. You can apply to any company and they will have a job.
Got in-house.
Exactly, Like, they will
data
have a
scientists.
Job.
Data scientists.
Exactly. So, like, every company needs, like, someone who's, like, techie, even though if it's just tech support, you still need someone who knows
computers. Yeah. And we're seeing that in obviously fashion over the last 10 years, say, a lot of the jobs are being moved away from the traditional fashion graduates I'm the employability lead in the department, so I engage quite a lot with industry. Mm-hmm. And they're always contacting me now, have you got any contacts in the computer science department? And you're like, what about my students? And that's where they're looking. They want the data students, they want the computer science students, because essentially it's all about e-commerce, isn't it? It's all about online selling. And we kind of need to find a way of merging your brain with, you know, the fashion students. And, you know, you're gonna get this hybrid amazing.
I loved talking to you about this the other day, because this kind of technology side was way more kind of already woven into the fashion industry than I would have realized. And that was kind of forecast modeling is something that we know a lot of businesses use. But you were telling me about things like 3D modeling, which almost sounded like computer graphics.
It is. So it's kind of taken leveraging a lot from like the gaming industry. So, you know, we're all used to the PS2. Or what PS are we on now? Five. Xbox, whatever. And the gaming, and, you know, even it kind of started with companies then merging with fashion companies and creating skins for these avatars and these CGI characters and things. And then obviously fashion quickly realized that there was a revenue stream to be had in this, and that the younger consumers, because it's always about chasing the youth, because then you've got more of a consumer life cycle out of them. So if you capture the consumers while they're still young, you can obviously maximize their value. And then obviously realizing that younger consumers are more tech driven, the digital natives, you know, they're just now become accustomed to living in this virtual reality world and bridging both sides of the coin. So then fashion companies started realizing, hey, we can create maybe digital products and then sell digital products as an additional revenue stream. And you had companies like Nike and Adidas who were, and Tommy Hilfiger, who were very, very, you know, early adopters and innovators of that technology. And then it just became really mass appeal. And now we're looking at 3D modelling and 3D technology as a way to mitigate the waste. We know fashion industry is one of the most polluting, wasteful industries. I think it's number two in the world. And so we really need to...
It's a real hot topic, isn't it? Yeah. Especially with fast fashion.
And 40% of that waste actually comes from the sampling that goes on. Even just to get one garment, then there may be 40 to 50 different samples, just to kind of get
that
final sign off. So if we can mitigate the need for having to sample and having to have everyone in that kind of that process, the factories, the buyers, the garment techs, you know, and it could just be a 3D version of that product, and it's hyper realistic. It looks exactly how you would after it's manufactured as an end product, but you can still make those key decisions as you would, like drop the sleeve, maybe the colorway, maybe that print's not quite working, maybe enlarge the print, all those decisions that go on. But it used to go on because you had the real garment in front of you as a sample.
Yeah.
And then thinking about the manufacture, you would manufacture in, you know, in Romania or in China, and then that product would then be shipped over to your company in Europe. It doesn't work. So then you have to then, just that whole logistics and carbon footprint that was happening just to get the sample signed off. And that happens for every single garment that everyone's wearing in this room.
Yeah.
So if we can use technology, if we can use like computer graphics and 3D modelling to mitigate a lot of the need for that waste, then essentially we're really helping the process. And companies like Hugo Boss, 99%, I think 90% realistically, of their online products that they're selling via their e-commerce website is graphics. It's not real products. So the more companies kind of get on board and start to leverage 3D technologies to, you know, to essentially kind of curate and promote their products online, the better it is for the planet.
And it's crazy you say that, because my dad has a factory, a manufacturing factory.
Okay.
And I can see him bringing like samples, you know, and I know exactly what you mean about this, because it's, you know, it's crazy that you're here and talking about this, because like this is what my dad's business is. And like I see the amount of samples he has to bring to the UK, and then he has to get them approved, and then he takes them back, and then you have to bring them back. And it's, I get what you mean now, because it is so wasteful. And to take them back and forth again, it dies again. Yeah. So
and then
wasteful.
They all need to be fitted on a model.
Yeah, exactly.
So now we're seeing kind of hyper-realistic avatars now as being part of the model, now being part of the fitting.
I was just about to ask about that, because it's kind of possibly like 20 years ago, it would be unimaginable that you'd be able to so realistically render like this jumper in 3D and then be able to make decisions based off that representation.
Yeah.
I wonder if the next step is going to be to kind of like cut waste down and sustainability, just maybe having people upload an avatar of themselves, which they try on different sizes on, so then they're not buying things and then they're getting wasted when they're sent back.
And that's another wasteful, you know, online selling is wonderful. It's, you know, it's very convenient. You can shop wherever you want 24 hours of the day. But again, like you said, you've got the returns, and that becomes the waste, because if you don't resell those returns, because invariably you've got makeup on them from trying on and stuff, those things are never going to be resold. So again, they go to landfill. I think companies like, there's a company called Zalando in Germany, and they've been trialing, like they have a 3D body scan on their app. So as a consumer, you can just scan your body and then it would recommend the best size option for you. Because what consumers do, especially for very cheap fast fashion companies, they'll speculatively buy a multiple sizes, because they know they're not going to go in a store and try on. So they'll go, oh, maybe I'm a 12, maybe I'm a 10, maybe I'm a 14. So they'll buy all three sizes just to try on at home. And then they'll keep the one size and then not send those two sizes back. Again, waste. Or they'll send it back and that will just go to waste. So there's a lot of real issues in the fashion industry, but hopefully we, you know, in the fashion industry, there's a common feeling that it's the technology that's really helping at the moment to kind of mitigate some of the wasteful practices that is happening.
No, it's so true, because even us, sometimes we order like two sizes because we're not sure about the other one. And when life's so busy, sometimes you just forget to return it. So it's such a real problem. And like, you don't even clock that this is wrong until, like, you know, you're pointing it out and I'm realizing, oh yeah, like, it's so wasteful and it's wrong. And there should be something done about this. And it's great that you are doing something about this. And even when you go on websites now, like, it's getting a tiny bit better, because you can go and, like, put your height in, put your size in.
Yeah.
And you can actually get, like, what your best size could be, or what your best shoe size would be. Yep. So it's getting better, obviously, but like, there's so much work to do, because even us as people who are trying to work towards a better environment, even we're not aware of our footprint, like how these things are causing these issues. So very interesting.
I find it so crazy as well, like, the journey you've been on in the fashion industry and now in academia. It's kind of all these elements that are so important, sustainability and the technology coming in. Was that something that was on your radar when you first thought fashion is the direction I want to go into? Okay. Because you might not know what it is that you're going to be talking about.
And I think we were talking about sustainability when I was a student, and it just seems to be a concept, a construct that we're constantly debating and constantly really thinking about how we reduce waste, how we do this, how we do that, how we, you know, develop more sustainably. But it doesn't really seem to be gaining a foothold, a really solid foothold on the market. There seems to be a pushback on the consumer, as though it's the consumer's responsibility to make brands more ethical, more fair, more sustainable. But it's not the consumer's responsibility. It's regulation, it's government, it's you know, it should be a top-down approach, and there should be an accountability there. And the problem with companies is they don't know what sustainability means, and they don't know, they can make these grand claims like, oh yeah, we're sustainable, like H&M could say, yeah, we're sustainable, because maybe 1% of their range or operation is more manufactured using recyclable materials or something like that. But 99% of their products is not sustainable. But they can make these.
About greenwashing. Yes. Yeah, how H&M did it.
Yeah, and most companies do it. And they can kind of get in because they're just manufacturing one range that's sustainable. But I think companies, there's all these loopholes, and I think there needs to be tighter regulation. And I think now we've got, obviously, we're moving forward with the Sustainable Development Goals, UN Sustainable Development Goals, and textile, you know, 2030 and things like that. I think there will be some kind of measure where they have to adhere to certain practices. And what we're seeing now is the use of, like, blockchain technologies and RFID chips incorporated into garments, so that you can track the provenance, but also where that garment ends up, essentially. So if you have these blockchains and RFID chips, if most of your garments is ended up on landfill somewhere, it can be traced back to you, and then you can be made accountable. Okay. So again, that's technology, isn't it? That's computer science.
Yeah, it is. And RFID tags, this is such a big thing these days, because it's not just for garments, it's for a lot of things. So, like, I worked at a car company, and they would
that was your industry.
My industry was at a car company, and they will put those chips on the cars, and they would track them around, and this way they not only saved on, like, let's say otherwise a worker would have to constantly note down what station the car was at. This way it's just on the computer, on the system, that if you want to search up a car, that's actually my third year project where, like, if you wanted to search up a car, you could just have this, you just search it up on the system, and you tag the cars. So it's quite interesting how, like, you know, it's completely...
Is that driven by waste? Like, the need to be able to track where those cars end up? Or is that... What's the purpose for tracking them from, like, a car industry perspective?
Basically, so let's say it's a massive factory, right? Mm-hmm. And a car could be anywhere in this factory. It could be in the painting section.
It's tracking where it is in the factory.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
So like, I thought you meant like the world.
So otherwise, even on the stations, like sometimes, like let's say there's three steps for a tire to be fit into a car, right? And you need to know, like I'm on the business side of things. I come in and I'm like, okay, where is this car right now? I want to know. Now, if I ask a worker, he's just gonna be like, oh, well, he's just gonna be scrambling about like, oh, now we have to find a car. Where like amongst like 1,000 cars which are currently being made. So it's so good to like have this like RFID tags, so like you could just search it up and you know where this car is at the moment. But it's crazy that, you know, it's being used in fashion, because in my head, I just never like think
but
about
these
things. You
know what? Fashion does leverage a lot of the kind of practices and processes from the automobile industry. Yeah. You know, it's lean manufacturing, you know, Henry Ford, you know, he was the father of lean manufacturing. We do steal a lot.
The similarities, it's crazy.
It's still components, it's still manufacturing, it's still, you know, a usable asset, isn't it?
Also, you know, fashion as a sector has so many people from computer science, maths, data science backgrounds now working in it. Everything is very much more connected than I think, especially at university when we see subjects in kind of strict disciplinary lines. It's much more woven together than maybe we know when we're starting out.
I think so. I think that in academia we need to become more agile, and we need to make sure that there's opportunities for students to work interdisciplinary. Because when you go into industry, like you said, you're going to be working with computer scientists, you're going to be working with, you know, lawyers and, you know, everything that makes up an organisation, you're going to be working with those people, and you have to be used to kind of learning that different language. Like, you have a code, you have a language. I may not understand your language, but I should be able to convey to you what I need, and you the same to me.
Exactly.
If I was a student. But I think in education it is quite compartmentalized, and people work in their departmental silos, and the students work in their departmental silos, and there needs to be more opportunities for students to kind of come together and work on joint projects.
Definitely.
And have those.
So that's something that you feel as well.
I've definitely, like, she's so right about this, because I just never would have thought. I've applied to about over 100 companies up till now, right? Because as a graduate in computer science, the market is very saturated right now. So like, you're just scrambling for
a
job.
It's that rite of passage Charlene is talking about.
I'm going through what
you've been there.
But I have not applied to a single fashion company.
You should.
Because you should. I know I should. Yeah. Now that you're talking about you it, now I want to. Because.
Yeah.
But
my
partner,
it's such a massive skills gap as well. The fashion industry is crying out for graduates who have the technology, the technical skills, the computer science skills, the data skills, because it's such a massive need. Yeah. That is the industry at the moment, and it's not showing any slight signs of.
I know.
Yeah. So
we just never hear about this, you know, that we have career fairs. We have people like telling us, oh, you should apply to this company.
I was going to ask you, is that something that's kind of well spoken about? Like the idea that you can work in many different sectors. It doesn't have to be just a computer science or data science.
It is, because as I said, like right now, any company could have, a computer science job, something that's techie. But again, fashion is not spoken about. It's just, it's not,
it's like
a dirty
word. No, stop it. But when you think of fashion, in my head, you're always thinking of like clothes and like, you know, the trends. You never think, oh, me, a computer scientist and with the fashion people. Like a lot of people don't think that. But then like right now, like you just, the way you're speaking about it, like it makes me want to go and work for this, because like you have, it's got such a broad like range of, you know, there's so much you can do.
You're at such a good stage, and I think both of you have spoken to me about experiences that you've had kind of going into education, and kind of gaining that work experience is so important in exposing you to different environments and helping you realize which ones you want to be in.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it has to always be a year in industry, but you did a year in industry and you were like, this is very useful skills. But it was then the question, do I want to be in this environment when I leave? And Charlene, I know you gained loads of work experience when you were kind of an undergraduate.
Definitely. And I worked a lot for free. Back then, it was just like the standard practice that you did. You didn't get paid an industrial placement. And, you know, that, but you kind of had to really pay your dues almost. And
how did you manage that? How did you find places that you could live? Yeah, financially manage to go and do that kind of work?
I was always quite savvy in terms of making money. You might want to cut that out. Not in that way. I was, my mum, she did a lot of community work engagement. So back then, I'm not sure if it is the case now, but there was a huge like youth club culture, like youth and community work culture. And you could pick up work with working for a youth club, working for a local council, anywhere, any borough, like type of thing. So whenever I was working in Manchester, for example, I'd just go and get paid working for like a youth club in Wivenshaw or Whalley Range. If I was working in London, I'd just pitch up and work in like Camden or Hackney or something like that. So I was always able to kind of just make money. And then I was selling things as well. I think back then, we, you know, me and my friends had our little market stalls. There was nothing to do with e-commerce then. There was no online. I had my own little market stall.
What did you sell there?
We sold everything and anything. We'd make to order. So, you know, young girls would come up and say, I want this outfit for the weekend. And we'd run up outfits for the weekend and we'd get paid quite well.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and we were kind of doing made to order, bespoke before made to order was a thing. And yeah, we had such a good time. It was a blast. And, you know, you didn't feel, and I think we used to live off, you know, £5 a day or something, or we'd go out, we'd feel like we'd go out with £10 and come back with £15, you know. You always find something to kind of have a good time with. And I feel it's harder now. I think it's more difficult for graduates. It doesn't seem to feel like you can, it feels like everything's more expensive, everything's more expected. And you kind of really have to have yourself together at a very early age now. And back then it was like we could just be experimental and go into different industries and try different hats on. It didn't feel like we had to have our whole life mapped out at a very early age. And I always say to students, like, don't feel like you've got to graduate and walk into the job for the rest of your life. See a little bit of the world, travel a little bit, explore, experiment, start your own business. You know, you've got social media now. I'm not sure why there's more people aren't leveraging social media to their advantage to monetize it. And, you know, you don't have to wait for somebody to hire you and give you a job. You can actually be going out there and making money for yourself.
You're very aware of that whole kind of unpaid internship element being a real barrier for people from all backgrounds being able to do that, because it's not possible for everyone. And I love some of the work that you do at the universities, kind of involving industry projects that the students get to do in a module while they're studying. So they can leave having that, even if they've not gone working in industry. And I think you'd also talked about like a summer internship type thing, which you're looking into.
Yeah, we've got a number of things happening. When I first took over as the employability lead for the department, it was a case of you either got an industrial placement or you didn't. And there was no other exposure to industry. So I realised very quickly, and some of the kind of institutions that I've come from, like before I started at the University of Manchester, it was, industry engagement was just standard practice. Live projects were just incorporated into the curriculum. And then when I came to Manchester, it didn't really seem to have that approach because it was more academic. It's a Russell Group, you know, Redbrick University. So I realised very quickly that the skills and knowledge gap between industry and academia was was huge. It was very vast. And I just kind of made it my mission to set out to narrow that gap and bring more industry to the table and establish, incorporate live projects, because essentially, you know, a large cohort of our students are international. They may not, do not want to go out and do a year in industry. Mm-hmm. It's a whole year. Additional fees, additional, you know, yeah, finances. Absolutely. So sometimes students just want to get in, do your degree, and get out. I always advocate industry experience because it just shows that you've had that exposure to industry. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it doesn't have to be a year long exposure. Yeah. You could have a 6 month exposure or one unit, 12 week exposure, where you're engaging with different industry, you're still consulting, you're still developing work based on their kind of business challenge, and you're pitching to them, you're presenting your ideas, you still have that feedback loop from the industry, and you can put it on your CV. And it doesn't, nobody's quantifying how long you've had that work experience for. What industry really wants to see is that diversity of experience. Yeah. So volunteering, for example, still really adds value and really helps you to enhance your kind of transferable skills.
When it comes to going on this journey of getting industry experience and kind of putting yourself out there, how do you find it kind of getting the confidence to kind of muster yourself up and think, yes, I can do this? I'm going to apply for all the things I really want, even when they're a bit ambitious, you know. Do you think that comes from having a support network? Do you think that comes from within?
I think it's all of the above, honestly. Yeah. First of all, you need to believe in yourself. You need to know that you can actually do this. Otherwise, like, even if like 50 people are there telling you you can do this, if you don't think you can do it, you will never do it. So, and that's where, like, being a woman in STEM is like, it's like you need that kind of support around you to, for people to say, yeah, like, I think you are great at this, you should go and do this, because we don't hear this a lot. I think personally, yeah, and we should be hearing this a lot, because look at you, like, doing so much, you know, and like breaking barriers. And I bet, like, when you were young, no one really said, oh, like, you know, go and, like,
no, there was no guidance.
Yeah, exactly.
There was no guidance. And definitely it does really help to have representation. You know, if you see somebody like you who looks like you in a career that you aspire to have, it's compelling, it's inspiring. The problem is you don't see that many role models or women representation in STEM. It's still a very male-dominated industry, and, you know, even from an academic perspective, it's male dominated academics and profs and things like that at the university. So I think for a young girl kind of venturing into a STEM related subject, I think you need to do a lot of work before they come to university to encourage them into careers in STEM, because they may not see themselves reflected in that type of career. And I think that we need to do a lot more work around that. And I know that there's some really fantastic initiatives in the university. So there's the Great Science Share that's led by Lynn Bianchi, for example. And she's really engaging with the schools and young girls in primary schools, secondary schools, to really show them that you can come into, you know, there's viable career opportunities within STEM-related subjects. And the problem is not many people know what STEM is.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it is taught in schools, but not taught in a way that really tracks, like, it shows, that presents career opportunities. And that's what people want.
Yeah.
So we need to wrap up in a minute, but there's something else I want to ask before we get to, like, the final kind of question of today. How did you find communities and support on your way into STEM? Was there any advice you could give somebody who's looking to find people that might be in the same situation as them?
I'd say join societies. Like, if you're in uni or even school, they have societies. I definitely say join some. If in your course, try and, because the first thing I did when I joined uni was try and find girls that were in my course. That's the first thing you do. And also like girls who were like me, who understood, who could relate to, like, my experiences. So, like, if I didn't know something, she was right there saying, oh, yeah, I don't know this either. Let's learn this together, you know? And if you can't find it in your course, there's why is women in STEM, that's a whole society. And there's just girls out there like who are in STEM and like are ready to just become friends with each other and like help each other out.
Mm.
And I definitely say like there's places like these where like your friends, mostly girls, who make you feel so, you know, like just understood basically.
Yeah.
Mm.
And it's so important. Yeah.
It can be quite intimidating, can't it? Uh-huh. Coming into it, yeah. And not feeling like you're invisible. And B, mm-hmm. you don't have a voice, and that mm-hmm. your voice is not valued in these spaces. And I think for a young student entering, I think what you just said there about finding that sisterhood, finding that sense of community and belonging, mm-hmm. I think that really is true. Mm-hmm. And even as an academic, I've now found other women, other females in my department who I lean on quite a lot. And, you know, we share kind of experiences, and I look up to them because they're in positions that I aspire eventually to mm-hmm. be in.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have to have a balance between people who are just like you and people who are just there yeah. that you aspire to be, because yeah. you can learn a lot, and they're yeah. your mentors. They become your mentor. So I would always advocate having a mentor and finding mm. people who can really help shape your career as well.
Mm.
I've got one last question for both of you today. And that question is, if you could give yourself one piece of advice 5 years ago from where you are now mm. that would have better prepared you for life since then, what would you say?
I'll let you go first.
Oh, gosh. I actually don't have anything deep. It's just a really funny one. When I first moved to the UK, I didn't know anything, basically, right? So... Buses. So, I'd just be stood at the bus stop, and like the bus would just come and go, and I would just be sat there like, why does it not stop for me?
So your piece of advice would be put your hand out for the bus.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I have a lot of deep things I can say, you know, because but I've said them already. Go yeah, and make friends.
Talked
yeah,
about them,
find
I guess.
Society. You know? But,
oh,
put your hand down for the bus, and also press the stop button on the bus, because it's not going to stop otherwise. So it's very important. Anyone who's just moved to the UK, you need to remember that. Well, I'll let you take over.
I can't possibly follow that one. Oh gosh. I would probably have
you off now.
Probably just don't wait for others to tell you what to do. Just, you know, nobody's in charge of you and your life other than you, and nobody can tell you what to do with your life other than yourself. Yes, you can have aspirational, inspirational people around you, but essentially you are the director of your own story, aren't you, at the end of the day? So I've probably wasted a few good years of my life just waiting for permission, and mm-hmm. nobody's ever going to give you permission because everyone's so concerned with their life.
Mm-hmm.
No one's caring about
you're
your
the
life.
Main character.
Yeah, you are the main
exactly.
character. Exactly. And get onto social media.
Oh, yeah. So important. You can get so many places with social media, you know, and like
yeah.
the people who are actually on it, on TikTok and on YouTube making videos, even if like they're not getting anything, they're not getting views, just I love that they're doing it, because it's taking you, it's the capability of it to like take
the
you
amount
to
of
so
opportunities there,
yeah,
even
exactly.
just in terms of finding careers now, it's
exactly.
all about LinkedIn.
Exactly.
You're getting headhunted on LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
It's not via those traditional channels anymore.
Yeah.
So
I'm on LinkedIn, and like
yeah.
sometimes it's depressing going on there because someone I bet
because everyone's doing so much.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But like then you get messages yourselves from like big companies saying, oh, would you like to like apply to this job, would you like to interview for this?
Mm.
And then you're like, oh, okay, like maybe I can get somewhere with this as well. So it's
yeah.
it's important, yeah.
But we have to end there, and it's been lovely having both of you today.
Okay.
I hope you've enjoyed it too.
Yeah, it's been
it was
wonderful.
So lovely, thank
yeah.
you. Yeah, thank you for having us. Yeah.
That's all. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.